They were not particularly political in any way. So a bunch of people were just fooled in a way that they were promised something and they never got it. What they got was repression, poverty, and state dictatorship. From my point of view, it was not pro-Russian. It was just Russian-speaking.
Hello, and welcome to episode 35 of Let Them Eat Cake. My name is Jack. My co-hosts are John and Ace. Today we are talking to a Ukrainian active duty soldier from Crimea and queer icon. But before that, let's get into some headlines.
We just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge that Morocco has been hit with a 6.8 magnitude earthquake on the night of September 9th. And thus far, 2,000 plus people have been confirmed dead, with many more bodies being dug from the rubble by rescue teams. And the earthquake could potentially have caused billions of dollars in infrastructure damages. If you can, and you have the means to do so, please look into some legitimate charitable organizations you can support in relief efforts.
Okay, so now let's take to the regular news with the G20 conference. It's the top 20 global economies, and then there's like some guests that come along. It's basically the Illuminati meeting.
So the G20 took place in India this weekend, where, as said, was the top 20 economies with their heads of state, excluding Russia and China, who chose to send an envoy instead. They meet to discuss how their economies will function for the next year and plan for the future as they see it. Topics discussed over the weekend included green development, sustainability plans, reform and support for both physical and digital infrastructure, among many other things. A major part was countering China's Belt and Road Initiative, although it wasn't said explicitly, while also adding the African Union, just like the EU, and equaling their status in the G20. On environment and green technology, I do not care what the top 20 economies have to say while they continue to refuse and avoid calling out China for being the highest polluter and increasingly so. While that's happening and the world continues to falsely claim that China is the leader in green technology, their $4 trillion pledge a year means absolutely nothing. Ultimately, this will likely lead to no real change. They're voluntary non-binding agreements, after all. Absolutely no mention of, or hard condemnation of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, instead softballing the entire argument. You can argue that this is a good thing because we need Putin at the table as well as Xi Jinping, despite their inclination for genocide. There is every chance that we can stop it that way before anything needs to escalate.
How many times was the word inclusive mentioned in the document?
49 times.
A lot of that stuff. Like inclusive, clean, a lot of adjectives.
Yeah, very strange. Very, very strange.
Well, you know, they're not they're just not going to do shit about the environment.
No, nothing's going to happen. They also wanted to do some reforming of financial institutions. I think a couple of reserve banks were in that list. More transparency and accountability and multilateralism to institute the 2030 agenda, which is the UN's agenda.
What's more important than the G20 is that Joe Biden left the G20 early and went to Vietnam. Obviously, it's kind of a big deal for a U.S. president to be talking in Vietnam. Modi in India, he has been using the G20 just kind of to be like, you know how Qatar did with the, the Olympics that they had? It was just, you know, they're trying to hide
the World Cup.
Yeah, that was the World Cup. Okay, they're trying to hide all the slave labor. They banned the booze, you know, that type of thing where they're using it as a power position. There was a lot of that with India. But as soon as Biden gets to Vietnam, like the first thing he says is that he raised concerns about human rights and free press with Modi, because journalists basically weren't allowed to cover this. So we had to use like all Indian sources. There's very few like foreign press that were even allowed in, if any. Biden called his trip to Vietnam a historic moment. It's a terrible speech. You can barely hear him because it's Vietnam and they don't have the best like AV equipment. But also there's they don't have AC either. So there's like a big fan above him. So you hear the fan instead of like him. He's so drowned out. And then he can't hear the reporters because of the fans. So he keeps like having these old man moments where he's like, what's that? Huh? But what he opens with is he says that the alliance with Vietnam is comparable to AUKUS. Really big deal saying something like that. And then he said the United States is a Pacific nation and it's not going anywhere. There's a lot of this invest in infrastructure stuff that we hear a lot. Mostly that's what this talk was about. So all the journalists want to know, every question was basically the same. And it's, why are you trying to snuff China out in the Belt and Road? There's some interesting doublespeak here. So Joe Biden says, I don't want to contain China. You know, he just wants them to play by the rules. He says, this is actually about creating a stable base in the Indo-Pacific, which sounds exactly like like fencing China in, exactly like he said he's not. He specifically talks about respecting people's airspace and things like that. So it's like clearly this doublespeak about how he's totally containing China while he's not doing it. And then he says that we're all better off if China does well because it grows our economy. But then immediately after that, he's like, they just need to grow it in the legal, transparent way. He also, at this meeting, he mentioned some infrastructure projects in Africa. He said he's going to build a rail line across Africa. He also mentioned that he specifically went to Angola to discuss major solar projects with the country of Angola. And then Lula has also been partnering with this. Said he's partnering with Lula for debt relief in the infrastructure projects in Africa that are already being built. AKA, he's going to pay off like China and Russia's debt on these projects and basically take them over. And then at one point, he starts rambling on about John Wayne and horses and how John Wayne is a dog-faced pony soldier. And then he shuffles back to the podium and says he has to follow the orders. So it's already like the perfect thing to clip to be like Joe Biden is a puppet, but it's like a joke because he can only call on five journalists there because it's like Vietnam, you know? So I think China didn't have a good time the last few days at these meetings. So anyway, speaking of infrastructure projects in Africa, that all depends on things like ECOWAS and the African Union staying together with, you know, a string of coups that we haven't seen since what? When's the last time we saw this many coups?
Well, I don't know. Coups are kind of like a thing people do in Africa. But Gabon, coup in Gabon. Now, a lot of you may not have even heard of that. So I'm just going to quickly establish where I'm talking about. It's a country on the western coast of Central Africa. And they've got a population of about like 2 million people. Very oil rich, produces like 200,000 barrels of oil per day. The oil accounts for like 40% of their GDP and 70% of their exports. They're an OPEC member. They're not a member of ECOWAS, though. Their economy is also like heavily driven by mining, specifically manganese. And for those of you who don't know why manganese mining might be important, pretty much every type of high quality steel that is made out there for a specific purpose has about 1% manganese in it. And it's basically used to strengthen the steel. Very mineral rich country and all that. But despite that, like a third of the population lives below the poverty line. So what happened is on August 30th, there was a coup in which a group of military officers headed by a guy named Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguema took out the ruling president Ali Bongo following an election. And Ali Bongo and his family more specifically have basically been ruling the country since 1967. So that's way too long.
Didn't this go around like an election? Wasn't he like almost like voted out or something? What
was
that?
So here's the thing with the election. So he technically won with 64% of the vote, but opposition parties were accusing him of vote rigging. The election was arbitrarily like delayed, quote unquote, like multiple times. Observer groups said that there was a lack of transparency in the elections. It was very like sketchy. And so following the elections on August 26th, there was like a lot of fear of like social unrest and a lot of curfews had been placed across the country. If you were paying attention to NetBlocks at the time, you might have noticed that like they were talking a lot about how Gabon had internet cuts following the elections. And I guess that's just to kind of,
it's kind of a thing with elections that you see a lot.
Yeah, it happens. It's a thing you see a lot. But yeah, internet was being cut, curfews had been placed, things of that nature. So what happens is on the 30th, the military officers who carried the coup, they come out on national television. They're calling themselves the Committee of Transition, the Restoration of Institutions. They said that Gabon faced a, quote, severe institutional, political, economic, and social crisis. So, and then they go on to say that they were going to close the country's borders, cancel election results, and that state institutions would be dissolved. And they also kind of had told some business interests in the country to like shut down operations, foreign business interests, I mean, like shut down operations and stuff. the most prominent of these being the French mining company, Eramet. Eramet runs the largest manganese, the world's largest manganese mine in the country of Gabon itself. They put Ali Bongo under house arrest. They arrested his son, Nourdine Valentin Bongo, for high treason and corruption. And other members of the president's staff had been like subject to raids or put under house arrests. In their statement, they said that they would respect previously assigned international commitments. So I feel like that might be, not to draw unnecessary comparisons here, but that's kind of different from the Niger coup, where there was like a lot of rhetoric about we Z out of the country, like now, you know, versus where the Gabon coup, they were like, you guys can stay, we're just new guys in power. So France and the African Union, obviously, they come out and they condemn the coup. Russia and China, who are also big players in the mining and the import of Gabonese oil, kind of express concern over the security situation. And, you know, they have their interests there, obviously. And France also has like 380 soldiers permanently deployed in the country to kind of train the military and kind of support them in whatever way they can. There's also this like really funny video of Bongo. He's like in under house arrest, and he's like telling people to like make noise and like, you know, trying to appeal to people. And people were kind of like using it and making remixes of it on social media, kind of similar to like the Zenga Zenga
new sound bites
that Gaddafi did. Yeah. So to like put into perspective how long the Bongo family has been in power, and I should mention Nguema, the guy who's like been sworn in as Gabon's president since the coup and is basically the mastermind behind the whole thing. It is believed, not confirmed, but it is believed that he is Ali Bongo's cousin. So that's funny. Gabon gained its independence in 1960. And like I said earlier, they've been ruled by the Bongo family since 67. Ali Bongo's father, Omar Bongo, gained power. He was like the vice president for a bit. And then the president, Leon Mbaba, died and he took power. And Omar Bongo basically kept the country under one party rule until 1990, until people kind of got fed up with it. And he started to allow for like elections, quote unquote, like very rigged elections. He was just an extremely corrupt guy, just embezzled millions of dollars worth of government funds to, according to like a couple American and French investigations. It was also apparent if you went to the country, like a lot of some French journalists, I don't know if you've seen it, but some French journalists went for France 24, like a few years back. And like Omar Bongo, the elder Bongo, had like this huge car collection, like luxury car collection, dozens of like Lamborghinis, Rolls Royces, Ferraris, like custom made stuff. And there's like pictures of them online that you can find. And yeah, after his death in 2009, Ali Bongo takes power in like a really controversial, obviously controversial election. And people were pissed off about that. So they took to the streets back then, and he wins re-election in 2016. Now, whether or not this spells change for the country, I can't really say, given that it is believed that the coup leader, Nguema, is his cousin. He's also not exactly the cleanest guy himself. His whole thing since he's taken power has been like ridding the country of corruption, and they've been like raiding these houses of people close to Ali Bongo who have like these just giant amounts of cash stashed in their houses. Like, the videos are amazing. The Nguema, the new guy in power, at one point, he's been very close in their inner circle for a while. For about 10 years, he was in like Morocco and Senegal receiving military training. And but the important thing is that a corruption investigation revealed that he has about like $1 million worth of real estate in Virginia and Washington, D.C. So call that corruption, call that what you will. Yeah, I mean, it just seems like not much is going to change with who's in power, but it is what it is. We wait and see.
Just to touch on a few other quick things, Thai democracy, basically we had the equivalent of a third party win in Thailand. And everyone was saying, yeah, we'll see if this lasts. It didn't. Also, Armenia and Azerbaijan is becoming a very hot conflict zone. The United States has announced that it's going to do joint training in Armenia, which is important because Armenia is mainly backed by Iran. And Russia is like the peacekeeper. They're former Soviet states. So it's always been in Russia's territory to take care of this conflict. They've shown that they can't. And it's also interesting because another NATO member, Turkey, what is backing Azerbaijan, but it's not like Turkey beefing with NATO members, especially the United States, isn't unusual.
Have you seen the, sorry to cut you off, but have you seen the upside down A that a lot of Azerbaijani like military
I was just looking at
trying to like replicate the whole Z thing that Russia was doing.
Yeah.
Or Z.
They have like a democracy freedom score of like 8 in Azerbaijan.
I mean, yeah, how long has Aliyev been in power since the 90s?
It's so funny. Is there anything else, any minor things that we want to touch on? Cartel violence, some of that's going on. Go to Popular Front. So to transition into the interview with Kaffa now, I just wanted to point out that like we have links to help fund her. Gas is important. Like,
I mean, she's repair, like diesel and repair.
Drone repair, diesel. She goes over it in there, but I just want to point out because like her phone was like dying towards the end, but we still like got everything. So if you're already listening right now, you should go down below and donate. Since the G20 was not brave enough to condemn Russia's war in Ukraine, here's an entire episode about their unjustified war and the invasion in 2014 of Crimea.
We have a weapon more powerful than the British Empire, and that weapon is our refusal to bow to any order but our own, any institution but our own.
Hi, my name is Kaffa. I'm an air reconnaissance drone pilot in Armed Forces of Ukraine, the 93rd Motorized Infantry Brigade. I'm a part of a team that flies drones, mainly commercial drones, like Mavic 3 or Matrice 300 RTK. Depends what we have on hand.
Yeah, that would be my follow-up question is, what is the supply like for what you need? It's obviously never enough with any military operation, but...
Drones, the accus for them, other drone parts, because they break, and there are places where you can fix them, and then you go there and you fix them. It depends on an operation, but it happens a lot that they get lost and they are very expensive. There's a lot of funny stories about that. Sometimes you lose a drone in a field and then it's a minefield, and then you question yourself and the surroundings and you think, and then you go there and you pick it up and you come back.
Besides landmines, what other kind of like risks do you face in your job?
Shelling, artillery fire. Dying from artillery fire or other kind of machinery, tanks are dangerous. They are scary.
Okay. Anyone want to ask a question about her job before we get into backstory stuff?
Oh, there is another person. Hello.
What
it's
is?
It's just really sunny.
Oh, no. I completely understand. I know what that's like. How do you learn how to do what you need to do? Like, how long does that training usually take?
Right now, there are special schools and special courses that are more advanced. What I did was short training. So, I mean, it also interconnects with the backstory. Because I came back to Ukraine and I knew what I was going to be doing. And as a civilian, I went through this drone school in Kiev and basically had a certificate and a full knowledge of how to do it. The tricky part is that it's never enough. So you always have to be capable of learning and being able to work with new technology, because DJI, the company that produces them, Chinese company, they don't want us to use it. They want Russians to use it, and they sell much more of their stuff to Russia. There are a couple of factories of DJI in Russia, so they all the time update the software of the drones, the way that it's harder to anonymize them, because basically our software needs to also get updated all the time. So yeah, since the full-scale invasion, there are a couple of schools and private contractors basically outside of Ukrainian army that show people how to do it, and then they can go and be drone pilots like I did basically.
A lot of, like, I guess, Westerners in general just haven't ever really had to do any military service, because here it's not really necessary per se. But in your position in the military, like, from kind of like a functional perspective, why is what you do important for like the greater goals of the Ukrainian military? You and people like yourself, obviously, in similar positions.
are we talking about motivation or are we talking about the operational side of it?
Do you also do like PSYOP stuff with motivation?
Yeah, I am very much into that, I have to say. I mean, every day I wake up and I have to motivate myself a lot. You know,
a little bit of both. You can go into like your motivations behind doing that. You can go into the operational aspects of it. Just
wow, this is big. All right. So first, operational work always for first, because pilots and air reconnaissance professionals are the eyes of the infantry. If drones and the drone pilot teams don't do it, people do it on foot. And this is very Second World War kind of shit, you know? It's not very modern and it's very dangerous. So in that way, it is crucial for missions and for successful missions also. Why are we gonna win? Because we're simply better. No, actually, because a bunch of civilians just said, yeah, fuck it. If I die, I die. This is my time to shine. I'm gonna go and learn how to shoot an AK and sit in a trench for months in a row just because I don't want my family to get killed. I mean, this is very boiled down. For me, it's a bit different because Russia came and took my home and I was a teenager at the time. Let's keep that in mind. And then everything changed a lot. And again, in 2022, it changed even more because they came back with more firepower and said, no, now we want it all. Now you're not going to have a place to live safely at all. And we're gonna make you all sing a Russian anthem now. And I did not really like that point. Also, my personal, like, deeper motivation that is not revenge is, I mean, this is, you can say it's PSYOP, but I truly believe in it.
PSYOP doesn't necessarily mean lie, you know?
There is no freedom under Russian regime. One cannot be a feminist, one cannot be a queer person openly, because one way or another you're gonna get negative feedback from government for that. And I do believe in armed resistance, and I think it is the only way to prove your point, basically. Yeah, that's that.
Just to point out, the, you know, like, the name of our company is Fifth Gen Information Warfare, so, like, you know, we fully identify with the PSYOP's label. We're all about it. If I remember correctly, you're from Crimea, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So back before 2014, there's a, you know, the most popular propaganda we hear about Crimea is just how everyone there wanted to be Russian anyway. So as somebody who lived there before 2014, this is going to be a two-part question. How pro-Russian was it? And then the second part of that question is, did you see anything coming post Euromaidan? Did you feel like, oh, suddenly there's going to be an invasion and our, you know, our peninsula is going to be gone? Was there any signs of it coming?
So it's a complex question. To start with the first part, Russia for decades was making it possible. The whole propaganda work and the whole populating Crimea with Russians in a way, because a lot of people had moved there after, I think, the 80s, something like that. And they were, native Russian or whatever. I mean, quote unquote. And they were not particularly political in any way. So a bunch of people were just fooled in a way that they were promised something and they never got it. What they got was repression, poverty, and state dictatorship. From my point of view, it was not pro-Russian. It was just Russian speaking, which is an interesting point. Historically, that was also because a lot of resources were put into making both Crimea and the east of Ukraine very tied to Russia economically and politically, mindset-wise. But to the second part of the question, I did not see it coming. It did not seem like it's gonna happen, because It felt like it happened in one very brief moment. Like, there was no real support of Russia. There was no, like, grassroots movement being really glad about joining Russian Federation, or, I don't know, all this, you know, crying grannies in this streets with the tears of joy. This is bullshit. This is bullshit. There was just a bunch of men with AKs in the Gorka uniform that took the parliament, shot a couple of protesters, and yeah, then declared themselves Russians, and so it went. An important part of that is to mention that there was quite present pro-Ukrainian resistance. Crimean Tatars, the indigenous people of Crimea, were not, absolutely not happy about what was going on, because they saw it coming, in a way. I guess it has something to do with the history of repression that Crimean Tatars suffered, because, and I guess they saw how it was in Russia, and the moment there was this, you know, coup kind of situation, they knew that there is nothing good waiting for them. And when Russians basically, and Russian military accessed the power, political and, I mean, like, armed, like, seized the resistance, they started repressing Crimean Tatars really hard for no reason at all. Like, stealing people, putting people in prison for whatever bullshit accusations, like, religious cases because they were reading books that are not allowed in Russia, stuff like that. A bunch of people, I mean, years later, got real sentences, like 15 years in prison, like Siberian kind of prison, which, I mean, is really horrible. At the time, I mean, I'm being dragged by my thoughts. Maybe you...
The only thing I would add is that I would describe it as genocide. Yes, of the Tatars.
Absolutely. And it's going on still, because they just continue doing it. They continue doing it. And I mean, there's a bunch of political prisoners that are not Crimean Tatars that are also still in prison for their pro-Ukrainian position. I mean, the most loud cases, Oleg Sentsov and Sasha Kolchenko, they got released, and they are now also fighting for Ukraine, but a bunch of people are still there. And yeah, it something that I always keep in mind, I guess.
So I just wanted to circle back to one of those points that you made earlier on the influence campaign to make the east of Ukraine more Russian, or more Russian-speaking, so on. Can you explain a bit about that and how sort of the operations went and what actually happened? Because this is a major point of the disinformation sort of campaign.
Okay, disclaimer, I am no historical expert, and it's all just from what I know and from information that I get and from what I've seen and read. Historically, before the full-on assimilation, east of Ukraine was Ukrainian speaking. And then, because of several genocides, Holodomor included, and the politics of settling them there, it became more and more assimilated. And Russian language as the main language in Soviet Union became the one. Also important to mention that somehow culturally, Ukrainian language was always considered, in the Soviet Union, considered the talk of the poor or whatever, like this peasant kind of thing, because in the cities, you know, the bougie stuff, you were supposed to speak Russian because the intelligentsia speaks Russian. And if you speak Ukrainian, it means you're from the village. You are a peasant, which is not considered something to be proud of. I mean, was whatever. We are talking, this is very, you know, just for the context. I don't want to... Yeah, I'm explaining complex things with very easy words, but I hope you are following. and it's not sounding like I really believe in that. And then later, after the Soviet Union collapsed, it became pretty clear that economical and political ties can be easily played by the people that are in power regionally. And then before the Revolution of Dignity, the president at the time from the area was also speculating a lot on that topic and Russian language and whatever, and it just deepened the problem. You know, like you take some political matter as in language, and in order to just divide and rule, they took it also as a cause, you know, of like a difference, you know, as to say, here are Ukrainians that speak Russian and here are Ukrainians that speak Ukrainian, and you are built different, so we're gonna make a political matter out of it. And Russia just took it as a part of a propaganda and used it to justify it, the whole war, basically.
Revolution of Dignity, watching that from Crimea, were you actively involved with what was going on? Were you aware of what's going on? Or were you just kind of like worried about like whatever teenage problems at the time?
I mean, we were watching it on the TV, and it was, I don't know, scary. I also wanted to take part in that, but it was not much going on in Crimea. It was not a lot of riot stuff, so I could not. Then when the armed Russian men started going in and at school, the program instantly changed to Russian, Russian literature, Russian language, Russian way of grades. You know, in Ukraine, there is like 12. 12 is the highest grade, and in Russia is 5. So it was instantly like, oop, and now it's different. And yeah, we had to sing Russian anthem, and we didn't. And we also faced repercussions for that. And I started...
What were the repercussions?
The teachers would tell us off and tell that, do you want to get repressed? Do you want your family to, you know, get a knock on the door one night? And we were like, no, but I mean...
Were these the same teachers you had prior to the occupation, or were they the same ones?
Yeah,
or different ones, I mean?
I mean, that particular teacher that we are talking about right now was Russian literature and Russian language specialist. So I guess she was just, you know, trying to do her job in a way. Yeah, I also started speaking Ukrainian in school, which was...
So you know four languages at least.
Yeah, I guess. I don't speak Russian anymore, though.
Yeah, and it was also... I mean... That's based as fuck to just know it and be like, I'm not going to speak it. Fuck them.
Yeah, I mean, it helps to know it, but I just, I mean, it's funny point also. But yeah, it was an unusual thing to do, to like not, I mean, everyone was weirded out a lot, including my family. And they were like, why would you do that? And I was like, because I just don't want to obey to what they're trying to do. And this is the only way I can do it.
Just a little bit about Euromaidan again. So after seeing basically the revolution be successful, for which anybody who doesn't know, it was basically an Occupy Wall Street style protest that overthrew their government without the cost of many people dying, 100 people dying and 11 cops. Anyway, so after you get that liberation, to just immediately be invaded by the little green men, as they like to call them, like, what was like the emotional slingshot there in that specific moment?
I mean, it was a bit like despair, you know, like they are free now and we are here fucking trapped. A lot of people and also like kids and their families left. Yeah. And for the record, me and my family lived there for a year because we had nowhere to go. And that was also kind of unslay. Yeah, it felt like, I don't know, it was not good. It was that you could see the change in the air, in the social connections. People were just afraid to speak their mind in a way. Like, there was no Ukrainian school anymore. I mean, yeah, once again, it's very basic, but it's also essential. It all boils down to the language and to having even the possibility to study it at school. They just took it away. It was not important for them anymore. I mean, it was rather important for them to make people forget it and to basically raise a new generation of people. And I think they somehow semi-succeeded in that task, that would identify themselves with this whole Russian identity. Yeah, that's scary, but it's true.
So let's get into like the actual displacement and how you left and then, you know, come back around to going back.
Yeah, we moved to Kiev and continued, finishing high school, basically. And then I went to university, and then there was like a shit show harassment case in the university. It was really horrible. And I decided to leave to Germany. Dropped out of the university. Main key point is in this whole living in Kiev time, I would say, is being engaged in a lot of queer LGBTQ plus activism and getting to know anarchists and getting more familiar with the whole movement. Kind of the time it was mainly queer and feminist grassroots stuff. Because I was too young to join an NGO and I didn't think it was, necessary. And now I don't think it's, cool at all. But, it was something that was not present in Crimea. Actually being able to protest and to engage politically from that perspective. And then... the university thing was kind of horrid. And then in Germany, I was the first thing that was very, very different is the way Germans protest and the way they, do political activism. Yeah, like the anti-fascist movement activism at the time in Germany seemed very pacifist to me because people were just walking very silently and like with no fire in their eyes on the street, being like, yeah, anti-capitalista, hoo-hoo. When in Ukraine, for example, on a 8th of March march or on Pride Parade Day, it would be like a whole very engaged kind of crowd that would scream, and then sometimes the far right people would come and then you would have a little fight. You know, it was a lot of action. It really did look like an action, and it was very motivated. And in Germany, it felt like everything's already fine. You know, it's fine. You don't have to be walking around and screaming that you are demanding this and that. And I was, kind of surprised and disappointed at first. Yeah, and then, fast forward to February and before February of 2022, it was really in the air. Before the full-scale invasion, there was a lot of news and people being anxious that it's going to happen. People started packing their anxiety bags, is it called that way?
You say like a bug out bag, you know, just your getaway bag, like you know.
Getaway bag, yeah, like a bag with all you need. And when it eventually happened, for maybe a week in a row, I would just sit in front of my cell phone and read the messages and text with my friends and my family and help people out, like plan how they would evacuate. A lot of people that I barely knew or like followed me on Instagram texted me being like, okay Kafa, we know you're in Berlin, can you plan the transportation route for us, or do this or do that, or can you meet us at the main station? Like, am I like just luckier than them? What is really the difference? And then a bunch of them survived actually the Battle of Kiev, and I'm really glad. Some of them later got captured. It was a mess. And the moment I realized that this is what is going on, I think I knew that I am packing my bags and at some point leaving. And I started preparing for that, and yeah, it eventually worked out.
obviously a significant portion of like the people who are currently in the Ukrainian armed forces are people who, like, you know, they weren't soldiers or, like, you know, involved in the military beforehand. They had kind of regular job. They were a student, or they were like a mechanic, or they were a teacher or whatever. So obviously just kind of the stress of what this conflict brings is something that's very new to a lot of people who are in Ukrainian armed forces. And how do you find that people like cope with that?
It's a good question. In my experience, it's really fascinating how human mind and human body can adjust to different kind of conditions. Because, I mean, let's face it, no one is made for seeing their friends die or extreme cold or marching 15 kilometers with a 50 kilo backpack. But the thing is, and the core motivation as well, is that it's either us or them. And a lot of people have realized it in the first days. The civil resistance was insane. I mean, all the stories about people just, you know, in the granny with a pickle jar kind of shit. Yeah, just the realization that it is fundamental. Like, Russians were prepared and they thought they're going to just march through Ukraine and just, yeah, well, give out passports like this and it's gonna be all fly. But it wasn't, because people were ready to give up their freedom basically to serve in the army for the freedom of others, which is essentially what it is. I mean, serving in the army is very much unfree. You can't go and have a walk or go sit in the park and eat an ice cream. You can't just sit in the car and drive to see your family. Your own time doesn't belong to you. You can choose what you do with your free time. Like, for instance, I was on duty before, and now I'm supposed to sleep, but I am choosing not to. So I do something that I think is important. The same thing is for other people. I have a good example. A friend of mine who's a DJ, who, as mentioned, joined Territorial Defense in the first days and is an infantry soldier also. He reads a lot and he started talking about his experience on Instagram, and a lot of people could relate to it. And to a lot of people, it was also something unthinkable. You know, the guy was just like a rock star DJ fella. And then another day he's there digging a trench, you know, somewhere in the Kyiv Oblast, preparing to die. But he didn't die, luckily. Getting on your own terms with it, I think, helps. And also knowing why you are here is important, you know, because, yeah.
I have a really dumb question that won't take long to answer before anyone else wants to go. So while you were living in Germany, you mentioned pacifism. And, like, famously, we have the Orwell quote of, like, being pacifist is pro-fascism. So, like, East Germany is notoriously brain-rotted tankies. So, yeah. What was it? Was there anything like that where you look out in the street while, you know, your friends are dying back home and there's people with pro-Russia stuff, you know, anything like that where you're like, I really got to get the fuck away from these people?
All the,
you know,
fucking time. All the fucking time. I mean, in Berlin, it was really, really fucking bad. I mean, I cut off connection to a bunch of people because they were like, yeah, I mean, a bunch of people there are Nazis in the army, so
NATO,
I guess they should die. And I was like, mate, if you say that again, I'm gonna crash your fucking head on this table. Really, like, no joke. I mean, this is, for the record, this was happening when the Mariupol was under siege. And, I mean, most of my time, I was just volunteering at the volunteering center, packing shit, doing translations. And it was excruciating. Like, one of the most heartbreaking things that I had to do. And if you think about it, it's not, I mean, it's just a translation, right? And it was a translation of a list of humanitarian necessities for Bucha. And that, it like, 6 pages in German, like English, German, Ukrainian, English. And then I did it. And then there was a follow-up letter that you don't have to send the result because there is no people to send it to. And then you go out, you know, in the evening for a walk. And then you see peace posters like no Waffenlieferung für die Ukraine, and you think, what the fucking hell, people? Like, all right, some people that I know were also like, yeah, like anti-fascist, saying, yeah, you know, I'm really against all this military support to Ukraine because I think the weapons should belong to people. And I was like, my friend, dear, look, how do you think it's going to work? So you just send a javelin to someone's address and then a post person delivers it personally? How do you think it works? Like, and also this controversy about the resistance committee, like they are not true anarchists because they are serving in an army that is a state army. Yeah, for me, it was all bullshit talk because on one hand, I see messages from the people that I know that there is no proper, like, bulletproof vests. There is no helmets because it was, I mean, a lot of people were joining the army. There was not enough stuff, not enough medical supplies, not enough anything. And then on the other hand, I see ordinary Germans being very pacifist, shitty, saying, yeah, well, we don't support that. Can you just be peaceful? Can you wrap it up real quick? Because we are really worried about the prices of margarine and bread and the toilet paper. That's like, yeah, well, all right. Yeah, it was horrible. That was also one of the main reasons that I realized that I can, like, I physically cannot stay in Germany for longer. Like, I get the ick from everything. That's
Germany will do that to you.
Yeah.
Another thing I did want to ask is oftentimes, I guess, like people here in the West and particularly here in the United States, we hear a lot about like the amount of arms or medical shipments or logistical support or whatever that might be going to Ukraine. And on the other hand, we also hear that sometimes this aid isn't distributed very well in the military. Like, not all units get kind of the same attention or supplies or whatever it is, or the same quality of supplies. Is this something that you have found might, like, has personally affected any units you've been in or anything of that nature? Or,
I mean, it's a matter of human factor always, you know, because some people are honest and some people are not. There is a bunch of different people in the army, you know, they think about themselves sometimes. Yeah, about the gear that state gives is fine, but if one wants to travel lighter... travel lighter... like, for instance, the... Sorry, the plate carrier that the state is providing is 12 kilos. And the plate carrier that I have, for instance, because Solidarity Collectives have thought of me, is 5, maybe 6, which makes a difference a lot because I myself is barely 60 kilos. The amount of stuff that I can power lift is a bit more limited, given that after a year and a half for other people and maybe 8 months for myself in constant dragging things here and there, your knees say goodbye. And if it's 12 kilos, it's a faster goodbye. When it's 6, it's a bit of a prolonged suffering. When one wants to get good quality stuff, they have to think about it themselves. And as about stuff being not delivered properly, yeah, it happens, but it happens everywhere in a way. Yeah, it's always better, in my opinion, to support big organizations like Come Back Alive or people that you personally know, and you know that the aid or the money that you're sending is gonna get there. But most of the time it's all right. Like the drones get there and the, I don't know, food, clothing, sleeping bags, necessities, they get through, and it's all right. The Red Cross is shit, though. Red Cross is bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was really frustrating for me in Syria, and then, like, having Americans be so ignorant of the world. And the mm-hmm. invasion of Ukraine changed everything. Suddenly people care about what's going on in the world. As somebody who already likes PSYOPs, what has it been like to not only see all these organizations come along, but then you also have like even organic information warfare like NAFO and stuff like that? How does that make you feel to have something just organic come up like that to actually do something about the Russian disinformation?
I fucking love it. I have to say it is absolutely fascinating to me to see it, and also to see it working or not working on people, and also how people realize a lot of times on social media what is worth of attention or what is not. So in a way, like a self-healing from the untruth. Because it is the amount of Russian propaganda in other languages is enormous. Like,
they are by far the best, like, at doing it. Like, their troll farms, they're like, their information warfare network is insane, and it's getting smaller every day now.
I think it's worth noticing that it's far less eloquent.
One of my favorite videos is they have the Azov crucifixion video that they made. I'm not sure if you've seen that one, but that comes up, like, I think it came out of Myanmar again, but it's like you can tell they're not nailing this guy to the cross. He's barely moving, and then they light him on fire, but it's like not even like him on fire. It's like above him, and then it like cuts.
I have not seen that.
Oh, that's the big one. I see it all the time in like MAGA forums and stuff. It's really silly how bad it looks, but there's
yeah,
tons of stuff
that's what like I that. Meant. That was what I meant. Some is just really bad looking, and people don't want to believe that anymore. And that's great. But on the other hand, it's sad to see how some people really buy it, you know, because it plays on their political desires or like their beliefs about right or wrong. Because, I mean, prices are getting higher, everything is kind of sketchy, and now this Ukrainian war is not coming to an end, and who is guilty of all that? And then, yeah, it's easy to, sometimes it's working, but I guess it's working on not so, people that don't check their information, I guess. And thanks.
Yeah, and that's, and now you have everyone just telling, constantly engaging with people, saying it's wrong and stuff, but, you know, you can't convince a paid actor. I think it's been, as far as the information sector, I think that's where I think it's been the most impressive with Ukraine, especially like just the way they use the media, just all the drone videos that you'll see. Those are just like so successful for keeping like vets overseas involved and invested. People who have like experienced combat see that type of shit. And then they're like, I need to help these guys. Like they're really going through it. They're actually being effective.
As like someone who's a queer activist and is queer herself, like, do you feel like you've been well received and respected by your colleagues or fellow soldiers in the Ukrainian military? Or
yeah, for sure. That's a good topic, actually. There are two sides of the coin. So people read me as a female person because I present feminine, and I was assigned female at birth. To many of them, the word non-binary doesn't mean shit. Because a lot of times it's just like, yeah, some people that are older or some that are not familiar with this whole agenda, let's say. And regardless of the fact that they don't know what that is, a lot of them have received it quite well. And they're like, yeah, well, all right. That's not something to be weird about, let's say. And that was really nice. There was also in the unit, basically, there was a bunch of queer people, and yeah, it was like a family. It was really super queer paradise kind of shit. I loved it. And the feeling of belonging was also there, you know, which is important, because yeah, I don't know, there is a lot of this, yeah, you're on the same side as Nazis and whatever. In this unit, not in this situation, people are different. Some are clearly homophobic, but that's their problem. No one had any problem with that here, and everyone was really supportive. Being different is also something that people spot really easily. Yeah, but I don't know. My phone is dying also, and I'm really nervous about that. So I'm really sorry.
We're almost done. So if it does die, it's gonna be fine.
It's 4%, Bebita. If it's gonna die, it's gonna be a disgrace.
Do you think, like, overall though, compared to maybe however long ago, like throughout your lifetime, things have gotten progressively better for LGBT people in Ukraine? Or
I mean, definitely, yes. Not for me right now, because the most queer thing I can do is just to look on Instagram, you know, and scroll through other people being great on their pride parades. But other than that, generally, politically, in Ukrainian society also, it was crucial, the queer movement and visibility. Going out in pride parades, being out in public, in a way, writing things, being just present in the media, it all somehow created this background for now militant presence. Like, for instance, LGBTQ military is like a group of queer Ukrainian fighters, and it somehow creates also the image and battles all the stereotypes, you know, because there's so many different people, not only, you know, gay men out there being represented, and they tell personal stories of the people also, which is something I think crucial for people to understand, that it's not some, you know, random image of, I don't know, super slay person, let's say, or person with a super weird makeup, naked. It's just the same kind of person as they are. And in this case, also fighting for them too. And it, I think the public opinion also changed, and it had a big impact on general public, this kind of stuff.
I just wanted to, if your phone's about to die, I wanted to make sure we plug anything like the PayPal stuff that you want or anything like that before it does. So
yeah, PayPal's good. It's going to be for diesel and for drone repairing and looking after them, and car maintenance. For bigger things, we launch fundraisers when we need something, or just buy it ourselves, basically.
Anyway, okay. we're talking about queer military stuff, and so I've seen it, like, infamously there is a really funny post with Solidarity Collective, because they post somebody in a skull mask and like people were crying about it, which was really funny. But then also we've had people, I mean, I see it all the time with you, especially, people are constantly like, oh, you know, Azov, you know, all that shit, which is just a core of the information, is to amplify like how fascist these people are, even though like most of the real hardcore fascists are dead and they died a long time ago in Donbass.
Yes, and also I mean, quite interesting undertones, this whole skull masks.
Sorry to interrupt you. I just want to ask you one thing about the skull mask, all right? Were you familiar at all with, like, anything about, like, a fascist group in America wearing a skull mask of an exact specific type?
Yeah, I was not familiar about that. I thought it's just an aesthetic. And I also have one myself, I have to say, because it's just this generic kind of buff you cover your face with, and sometimes it goes with that. I mean, it's hilarious. Also about the Nazi tattoos, like the guy that was on the picture of one of the Solidarity Collective's posts had this Otala with a sword. And I mean, all right, maybe in Germany, hardcore Nazis wear that. It's just really popular here, not among Nazis. I also have runes on my body. Does it make me a Nazi? I don't think so. People sometimes don't read the room, you know, and the context, and they're just like, yeah, this is a proof that this person is, you know, in a certain kind of environment. And it's just, I mean, there's a bunch of like lefty people that I know that've been in subcultural shit when they were younger, different kinds. Yeah, and they got all these tattoos and now they're in the army, and now what? Like, I don't know. And also, yeah, the spider webs gate and all this pipeline, you know, it's also an Azov thing, because a bunch of Azov members has it. No, a bunch of young men in Ukraine just have it because they think it's hot. All right, that's it. End of story. it's a lot of people from, as I said, from different backgrounds, and sometimes you just don't have a choice but serving with them. Azov itself is not just one battalion. It's several different units. That also has to be mentioned. And this whole thing about it being a Nazi project is very much blown to enormous thing by Russian propaganda. The people, I mean, I know for a fact that people that were a hardcore fesh were just kicked out of it when it got reorganized. The fella that is one of the commanders of one of the units, Andriy Bilecki, controversial guy, because he has a record of weird kind of stuff being involved in. But generally, the whole thing is very... it's not what it seems. I know a bunch of people from there and some anti-fascists from there. And it's not like they... It may look like, like a ritual and this whole, you know, Nordic stuff, the torches and the shit. But it's just... I mean, they also play into that narrative a bit because they do an amazing job in killing Russians. Like, the impact that they do on the front line cannot be measured, really.
I just wanted to interject real quick, because this is something really funny that, like, we went on a whole, like, investigation of, is that we saw this video and these guys were, like, drone operators and they had Daesh flags on their shoulders. We spent time tracking down like why they have Daesh flags on their shoulders, and we eventually came to the conclusion that it was literally just to troll Russians, because they would say they were using ISIS tactics by using drone bombs and stuff, because like ISIS pioneered that. So they started wearing ISIS flags ironically to mock them.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, because I mean, let's not be delusional about it too. There are people that wear the Totenkopf thingy on them, and a lot of times I've seen it a couple of times, and every time I approach them and I ask, hey, hello, what does it mean, I'm from Germany, do you speak a couple of words of German, and I start talking to them in German, and sometimes the reaction is very negative, like, yeah, well, no, and why are you asking? I'm like, do you know what that means? And they're like, yeah, well, I don't know. But most of the times they're like, yeah, well, I got it from a friend, and it's like, I don't really know what that means. And they are serious. To mock Russians also, you know, to seem cool in a way, but it's not cool, and no one told them that's not cool, and it just continues rolling, you know? Because, I mean, the Russians do be scared, and they do be calling us Germans, like, Niemcy, you know? And here's like a double trouble. I really liked messing with them on the radio, speaking German, I have to say. It was amazing.
It is pretty funny. Bring back dark memories.
Right? I mean, it was. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's just in general something people underestimate is just, you know, I mean, if you get any group of people that's over 100,000, and I'm sure the Ukrainian armed forces is a lot more than that at this point, you're gonna have a lot of different characters involved, and you know,
also a lot of people hate Russia of all different backgrounds, and they've come from all over the world to kill Russians.
Yeah, and it is somehow keeping the spirit up, because with some of the people that you have to interact because you have to interact with a bunch of people, I would not interact normally in my, you know, civilian life for many reasons. For them being men, for them being just a certain kind of background fellows. But you just step over that and you do it. And then it turns out that they also do some decent kind of job that they're supposed to do. And that what matters in the end of the day. It's not like... You know, it's not all black and white. This is some really classical thing to say, but it's true. Like, some of them are, people similar to me.
It's important you say that, just because it does seem like a lot of people from the area of the world that we're from tend to kind of think that, like, war is like a movie and there's clearly defined this guy's good, this guy's bad kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it is like a movie, but it's because I like to romanticize the things and not because, you know.
So
I write a lot of letters. That is definitely a movie part. I just sometimes in my free time sit there and write letters and yeah, very romantic kind of character. And I got letters also from people, which is really slay. And the books, I mean, really vintage.
Why do you think people in sort of Europe and America, Australia, all these sort of what you would define as the West, why do you think they're so easy to persuade in these arguments? Like somehow they've come to the conclusion that Russia is not the invading imperialist bad guy that they are?
Because people are easily manipulated, first. Second, because for a lot of people that have not faced and who come from generational wealth kind of background, or who lived their whole lives in the everything's fine kind of narrative. I mean, it is also a very cliche thing to say, but the more I dig into this topic, and from my own experience also, it is somehow turns out to be true. Someone who is not closely affiliated with an experience of some kind of, I mean, internal displacement or war per se, or doesn't want to educate themselves on the matter or self-reflect on the issue of their internal politics, as you said, the imperialist past of their own country, or what kind of politics the place that they live in or their government implements, they will not even, you know, come to the right conclusions in the way. Because for some people, the lack of research and the lack of empathy in a way, and the lack of wanting to really understand it, you know, that the world is complex and every socio-political problem is also very hard to comprehend if you don't for yourself work out the way it works, if that makes
sense. People don't want to learn, they just want their opinions validated.
Yes, yes, exactly. Like, it's not easy. It's not that, yeah, one day one country decides to invade another and then it's like, ooh, 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 and it can easily get sorted. Or it's not that a bunch of people in one area just, you know, willfully decided to join one of the biggest totalitarian regimes and voted for it. And it was 85% on the elections and it was all done, deal, sealed, crazy, amazing. It was not like that. And what kind of media one consumes also is very important. And a lot of times people just don't check their sources, and there is a person, yeah, out there on the internet talking very, very, looking very knowledgeable, you know, saying, yes, I was there. And I don't know, all Ukrainians are Nazis because look at this sign. And there is like, you know, an arrow and a dot and a red circle. And then it, that's it. But it's not always easily determined in our times what is true and what is untrue, you know, because of how everything's very meta interconnected.
Obviously, there's, like, again, this amassment of people in the military, but you also still have, you know, the people who are just kind of civilians living their everyday lives in the country. And how do you kind of find, at least in your experience and maybe the experience of those around you, like, how sort of the interaction between civilians and a lot of people with their newfound place in the military, like, how does that work? How does that, like, kind of affected the societal dynamics, family dynamics, things of that nature?
That's actually a really good and really deep question, because for me myself, it has been really, really hard to communicate and to stay connected to my civilian friends. And it took a lot of actual work from both sides to maintain that friendships and relationships, because some things are really hard to explain for someone who's not familiar with how it is in the army. There's very little time, and for long periods of time, it can happen that there is no internet connection, or there is simply no time or no energy to look at your phone more, because you were looking at screens most of the time when piloting vehicles. And also, sometimes it is like messing up with one's head that, yeah, it was really hard with my international friends also, because they, I mean, I know they are there, and they are there, you know, just chilling, basically, living their best life, while I, by my own choice, which is important but doesn't make it better per se, have to endure a lot of bullshit every day, like... yeah, lack of sleep, or like seeing things one is not supposed to see. Yeah, stress, people being ignorant and stuff like that. I mean, I'm also autistic, and it's been really challenging to communicate with normies every day, especially with like cis men who don't really get things. And sometimes it's really, really crucial to explain it to them. And the way I mean, I was living in a bubble, basically. In Germany, I was in my small queer bubble, and then it was also a Ukrainian queer bubble, full of people that get me from half a sentence. And here you have to elaborate, and I caught myself realizing that I also have to elaborate a lot why things are this way and not different, also for civilian friends, because a lot of them, especially in the beginning, were like, I mean, we just went east, like I in winter it happened really fast, and I didn't have time to say goodbye or whatever. And some of the people kept asking me, when are you gonna be in Kiev? Or some of them, are you coming back to Berlin? And I am there, you know, and yeah, by a missile hit, like really looking at this Instagram message being like, I don't fucking think so, like, not anytime soon, I'm returning to Berlin to have a cup of tea with you people. I mean, I would really love to. And it was also painful, you know, in a way.
You should gaslight them to come see you and then,
yes,
get them to
join. I mean, I'm trying, but some people
that's the way to do it.
Yeah, some people don't really want to do that, and I get it. Yeah, some people were also, like, saying, stay safe. They are wishing it from the bottom of their heart. But some days when I was reading this message, I mean, you were driving and you hope not to, you know, get a hit in your car with a Ptur, or like to drive on a landmine and just collapse, you and your whole fucking team in the car. And then you arrive at some place and you read this message, stay safe, and you're like, yeah, this is some cognitive disconnect, you know, I'm trying my best, but at the same time it's impossible, like I cannot control it. And also this, like, the feeling of lack of control. You can do as much as there is for you to try to protect yourself, like wear your gear, or yeah, don't stick your limbs when you're not supposed to. But in the end of the day, it's also a matter of luck. It's most of the time, it's just, it happens, and then it's over.
Apparently, Zelensky has signed in some orders to fire a lot of recruitment officers in Ukraine.
Oh yeah, because of the corruption.
Due to corruption. To be honest, I don't know exactly what was meant by corruption. Like, is it that they're letting?
They were taking bribes. They were taking bribes for people who didn't want to fight.
Okay. All right. Do you have any thoughts on that, or anything to make of that?
It's a really big topic. I don't want to sound entitled at all, or But sometimes it really does upset me in the way that some people think that they, some men also, think that they are gonna somehow, you know, dodge this fate of trench digging and serving in the military. But the fact is that it's not true. There's a lot of people in Russia, and there is not so many people in Ukraine. And one way or another, everyone who is able to fight is gonna either fight or do some other kind of job that is needed, like affiliated with the military. And what was meant, I think, by this reform is that a lot of people thought that they can just buy their time and pay to be like defined not well enough, like not healthy enough to serve in the army. But it's just a matter of time when it gets, I mean, when the system and the state finds out that this is bullshit and made you are perfectly fine and you can go and do what you're supposed
healthy body,
to do.
Healthy bodies for reinforcement.
Yeah, I mean, for real, it's really, I mean, I don't want to sound wrong, but people that I know and people who also taught me a lot of things, like commanders or officers or instructors that, yeah, were there and were telling us how to do things and teaching us how to shoot an AK, were not people of perfect health. There is no such person as completely healthy soldier. I mean, you can see I am myself a bit blind. After a TBI, I am also weirded out sometimes, and my knees hurt all the fucking time. I just don't think about it anymore. And, yeah, people are, that I mentioned do their job and drag really heavy things and run around with a bunch of shrapnel in their fucking bodies. Like, 7 TBIs, it's all fine. Fuck that and continue fighting. And I mean, it's also the choice that they're making, but it takes a lot of stamina to make that choice. And on the other hand, we have people who say, yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, my stomach hurts sometimes when I'm nervous. I was not born to fight. No, mate, this is bullshit. Like, my stomach also hurts when I'm nervous. This is just a human experience. Accept that you have a body and accept that it's gonna play games with you.
To wrap up here, I just wanted to say thank you for giving us your valuable time to do this. And I hope it changes hearts and minds and does a lot of help. So for Crimea now, it's basically the end game type thing. And there's a lot of talks of like, is that going to be on the table for negotiations, things like that. I was curious how hard it is to think about that, like you'll never go home again, that it will always be occupied by Russia.
Heart stopper, heartbreaker. Well, I came to my own terms with it. This is something that motivates me every day, that I want to go home and that I want the land back. And I want to see the place where I was raised and my family home. But at the same time, I fully understand that it might never happen because of many reasons. It may just all be destroyed. It may happen that, I mean, different scenarios. All right, let's not make it dark. But on the other hand, I better die fighting for it than not try ever. And
it's better to die on your feet than to live on your knees.
Exactly. And also, I think I got used to it in a way that I don't have a home, and it soon's going to be 10 years that the place where my backpack is my home. And it's just fine. It's not a problem anymore because you get used to it. And then it just becomes something that is a part of your identity. Being an internally displaced person or a refugee is something that breaks you, but you just continue living from that on. And I guess a lot of people can relate to that, and I'm really sorry about that. But also the most empowering moment of that is realizing it and also being able to fight back. And I think I'm really grateful to, well, military for taking me because I'm really annoying. And yeah, for the space and time to have this chance given to me. Because, well, fascists deserve to die and Russians deserve to have a payback, I think.